This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. Producer Justine Paradise is with us today for another installment of our ongoing series on the New Hampshire Vanity Plate.
Yep, and this week we talked to Paula Werma. She's a retired attorney in Concord.
This is a longer story than most. Many years ago, I was a child abuse defense attorney, and I went up against DCYF frequently in court.
DCYF is the New Hampshire Division of Children, Youth, and Families, and Paula feels that the statute is flawed and the process is not transparent.
And after a few frustrating cases, my license plate came up for renewal, and I picked 8H8DCYF. Didn't have the plate for too terribly long. Probably 2 or 3 months later, I had a court hearing, and about 4 days later, I got a letter from the Department of Motor Vehicles. May have been signed by Virginia Beecher.
Virginia Beecher was the head of the DMV at the time.
That said, we issued you that license plate in error. Please send it back. Nothing else was cited in the letter.
At the time, DMV regulations prohibited vanity plates which, quote, a reasonable person would find offensive to good taste, end quote. Paula says she sent a reply to the DMV's letter, certified mail, saying this was not an error. She'd requested the plate specifically. There was another volley of letters back and forth, and then...
One day, I was sitting at my house, and two state troopers drove up the driveway, armed with screwdrivers, and removed my license plates from my car.
Did you go out and talk to them?
Not so much. I happened to have a camera on me, so I went out and took their pictures. There was nothing else to do. I had no license plate at all. So I took a magic marker and wrote stolen plate right where the license plate should have gone and drove around like that for a couple weeks.
Did you ever get pulled over with the stolen plate on your license plate?
I did not. I must have been the luckiest person on earth. At any rate, because I was preparing for an out-of-state trip, I didn't want that. So I did take the number plate back to the Department of Motor Vehicles and requested the license plate gagged, G-A-G-G-E-D. And that's the plate I rode around with for a couple years.
Later, Paula picked out the plate AXE-DCYF, which went through, but she didn't get to use H-8. This all went down in 1999 and 2000. But 10 years later, a man named David Montenegro applied for the license plate Cops Lie, and the DMV turned him down on the basis that the plate was, quote, insulting.
Well, sure, the government found it insulting. You know, it's insulting government officials, in this case, police officers. That's not a basis to suppress speech, right?
That's Gilles Bissonnette. He's the legal director of the New Hampshire ACLU.
In fact, that's speech that goes to the core of what it means to live in a free democratic society, right? To permit speech that is critical of the government.
Bissonnette wasn't familiar with Paula Werma's plate, but he was one of the lawyers watching the Cops Lie case. And that case hinged on the DMV's regulations surrounding vanity plates, the one that prohibited speech that a reasonable person would find offensive to good taste.
And the issue in that case was, what does that mean? Because no one really knows what that means. You know, what one person would find offensive, another person won't find offensive.
David Montenegro, who has since changed his name to Human, all lowercase, he brought the case and represented himself. The ACLU filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, arguing that the regulation was too vague.
When we're dealing with speech restrictions that are vague, it is especially concerning because, I said before, vague speech restrictions give a tremendous amount of power to government officials because they're the ones deciding at the end of the day whether the speech is permissible or not permissible.
The New Hampshire Supreme Court looked at the DMV's language and declared the guidelines, quote, unconstitutionally vague. And so they effectively struck the offensive to good taste regulation from the Motor Vehicle Code. So what changed after that case?
So there is a new regulation in place. It came into effect in 2015, and it bans license plates that are perceived to display messages of racial, ethnic, religious, gender, or sexual orientation, hatred, or bigotry. And, you know, I think this may create, frankly, some of the same constitutional problems as the original regulation, because you're allowing favorable messages in one particular area while banning unfavorable messages within that same topic. So one of the things that this new regulation would do, for example, would be to ban a license plate that says, I hate God. But if it says, I love God, I-L-U-V-G-O-D, you know, that would be something that's permissible.
That would be an example, Bissonnette says, of viewpoint discrimination, which the government cannot do under the First Amendment. And Just a quick note here. We got in touch with the DMV for comment, and they replied in an email saying that the, quote, New Hampshire DMV has always made decisions to approve or deny vanity plates based on the current law and applicable case law at the time. As the law changes, our practice follows accordingly, end quote. But what all these cases bring up is, what is the nature of the speech on vanity plates? Is the vanity plate a public forum, or is the license plate a piece of government property? Because prior case law did say that the government does not need to permit all forms of speech on its own property. And it turns out we've been in this discussion before.
We sure have.
This is Lauren Chulgin. She's a politics and policy reporter for NHPR's State of Democracy Project. And Lauren, you reported on a New Hampshire vanity plate that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
It is true. The drama all began in the late 1960s when George Maynard placed a strip of electrical tape over the Live Free or Die on his license plate. And so George is a Jehovah's Witness, and he felt like the idea that freedom was more important than being alive, well, that went against his religious beliefs. So at the time, it was unfortunately against the law to put that tape on your license plate. So George ended up getting a couple tickets, which he refused to pay. Then George ended up going to jail, and the ACLU called and was like, I think you've got a case here. So what ended up happening was they went to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. George actually won. The state said, yeah, you know, you're not supposed to be compelled by the state to say something you don't believe in. But the governor at the time, Meldrum Thompson, was a big fan of Live Free or Die. So he actually ordered the attorney general at the time to take this thing all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's how Live Free or Die ended up all the way in Washington, D.C.
But this case, it became kind of a big First Amendment case, right?
It did, because basically the court decided that New Hampshire couldn't use the license plate as a, quote, mobile billboard for their own ideological message. So the idea here is the one of compelled speech, where the state can't compel a person to say or feel or present an idea that is theirs. And so George ended up winning. And this case has been cited in a lot of cases ever since, which George Maynard loves, I can tell you. And it was actually how I found out about it, because in a recent pretty popular case out of Colorado where a baker refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple, his attorneys in the beginning used the Woolley versus Maynard case, this case that we're talking about, as an argument that, you know, he can't be compelled to do something that's against his religious beliefs. So George Maynard and Live Free or Die lives on.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, just the idea that not speaking is also a form of speech.
Yeah, I was referring to it, you know, obviously the First Amendment is the first thing that we think, but this idea of compelled speech is really what this one's all about. And it's really interesting.
Yeah. So in other states, as far as the vanity plate goes, the Supreme Court has ruled that specialty plates are state speech because there's a more formal process. But something that Gilles Bissonnette said at the New Hampshire ACLU is that New Hampshire system is different. And that's something that Woolley v. Maynard underscored, that vanity plates are the speech of the driver in our state. And that if the state creates an open forum like that, it has to be careful to follow those First Amendment rules.
That is so interesting and makes a lot of sense, because New Hampshire people do really pride themselves in showing who they are on their plate.
We'll hear more from Lauren about that New Hampshire pride in a second. But first, whatever happened with Paula Werma?
You know, fast forward, I think it was two times ago that I renewed my license plate. And I went to the website, and on the website, it still said that you may not have the license plate that involved H8.
Like the acronym for, or the shorthand for hate.
Shorthand for hate. I wasn't really interested in having H8DCYF anymore for a variety of reasons, but I decided that rule had to go down. So I applied for I Hate Snow, which is true. I do not like driving in snow. So that's what I have now. It gets a few laughs.
But Paula Werma didn't just say it with a plate. She also said it with a quilt.
What I tried to do was tell the story. So I embroidered on the quilt literally Article 22 of the New Hampshire Constitution, which says, and I hope I get all the words right, free speech and liberty of the press are essential to the security of freedom in a state. They ought, therefore, to be inviolably preserved.
She also quilted the license plates themselves, the letters, the receipts, the newspaper editorials, and it took her 3 years to make.
I did submit it to the state fair 1 year, and I took the top prize for crafts in the fair. I've never submitted anything before.
to another fair before or since, but I won.
All this to say, speech takes many forms.
That was producer Justine Paradise for our ongoing series on New Hampshire's unique relationship with the Vanity Plate. If you have a story about your Vanity Plate, we want to hear it. Send an email to wordofmouth@nhpr.org, and we may be in touch for our ongoing series. And in fact, Lauren Chulgin, who we just heard from reporting on Vanity Plate speech and First Amendment litigation, you also reported on Vanity Plate speech from inside your own house.
It's true. Father's Day was quite the event in my family this year as I brought along my microphone and interviewed my family, because for as long as I can remember, my grandfather, my dad, my uncles, and my cousin have all had somewhat matching license plates.
So is it harder to report on the Supreme Court or on your own family?
I definitely think my own family, because they all kind of stiffened up and then were like talking in the background during my interviews, which I was like, guys, that's enough. So it's harder to wrangle them than politicians and court justices, I think.
Here's Lauren Chulgin in Hampton, New Hampshire.
For as long as I can remember, my dad has taught me that being a Chulgin is a big deal. The letters I-A-N at the end tell people we're Armenian. And being a Chulgin comes with a sort of value system. Chulgins work hard and never give up. They put family first. Oh, and they have to love sports. I mean, that's like not even a question. You're a Chulgin, Dad would say in high school when I didn't make varsity. Keep your chin up. And when my grad school friends were struggling to find journalism jobs in 2011, Dad was unfazed. You are Lauren Chulgin. You'll find one. The recession was no match for a Chulgin. And so given all this, it was totally normal to me to grow up in a family where your dad, grandfather, uncle, aunt, and two cousins have variations of our last name on their license plates.
I'm proud of my name and my heritage, and I want everybody to know it's me.
This is my papa, Bob Chulgin, my dad's dad. He remembers getting his first vanity plate in the mid-1950s, pretty much as soon as New Hampshire allowed them. Chulgin is obviously too long and complicated for a seven-letter plate, so Papa went with Chu.
Chu is the first four letters of my last name, Chulgin, and that's been a nickname for me for many, many, many years.
That nickname has stuck for generations. Papa's oldest son, my Uncle Bobby, was known as Chu at Timberlane High School. Then came Uncle Mark, Little Chu, then my dad, Barry, who now coaches wrestling at Timberlane and is Coach Chu to what seems like pretty much everyone on the planet. Dad also has Chu on his license plate, and he has for as long as I can remember.
Well, everyone always says, how do you have the same plate as your father? You know, because they don't look at the hyphens, so I get that a lot.
Dad and Papa found a way to beat the system. Papa may have Chu, but Dad has hyphen Chu hyphen.
What did you think when you saw it?
Oh, I loved it. It's another Chew on the road.
Uncle Mark and Auntie Michelle have one car with plus Chew plus, and another car with C-H-O-O-L-J-N, so like a smushed Chulgin.
A lot of my friends think that my family's weird, but it's
aren't
just,
we like
it's just the way it is.
A little weird?
Yeah, we all are a little weird. Lauren, you should know that.
Of course, you don't have to get weird with punctuation if you're the only Chew. So when Uncle Mark lived in Vegas for a few years, he had Chew all to himself.
I wanted to go national with the Chew plate. You know, I wanted the Chew to hit the West Coast, you know.
There was one surprise I learned while reporting this hard-hitting news. The matriarch of our family, Rose, my nanny, one of Plasto Market Basket's longest-serving and sassiest employees, without question. She once drove with our Chew on her plate.
No, you did not, Nanny.
Oh, I did.
You did?
Yes, and it cost me $25 extra, and I said, no.
$25 extra?
I kept it 1 year and gave it up.
No one loves a bargain like my Nanny. The license plate thing is now multi-generational, thanks to my cousins Rob and James. Rob had Chew when he lived in Hawaii, but James lives here, so he had to settle with J-Chew.
Why was it important to rep our fam?
Well, because I don't know if you heard recently, but our grandfather just got
Citizen of the Year.
Citizen of the Year for Plasto. So who doesn't want to represent a last name who represents a whole town?
And you have to imagine, this pleases my nanny and papa to no end.
So what did you think of everyone's responses?
I thought everybody was excellent, but I say hats off to James. I thought James hit the nail right on the head when he said, the reason why Papa did it and why all the boys do it, because they're proud of their heritage. And we're proud of the family that we've got. Why wouldn't we be? Take a look around, you know?
When I looked around, I realized I was just one of three people at the table who has never had a chew plate. I don't know. It's just never really been my style. But the more I thought about it, I mean, I guess I do have my own way of repping my family.
Any closing thoughts?
Thank you for the interview. It was a pleasure. Lauren Chulton signing off.
This is Lauren Chulton, NHBR.
Lauren Chulton Bear.
So Papa inadvertently makes a valid point here. I'm not just Lauren Chulton anymore. I got married in September, and I decided to keep both my last name and my husband's last name, Bear. So I'm Lauren Chulton Bear. But I decided a long time ago that my byline, my sign-off on the air, would always be Lauren Chulton.
Lauren Chulton signing off.
That was Lauren Chulton, politics and policy reporter for NHPR's State of Democracy Project and occasional Vanity Plate correspondent. Coming up after the break, how the Granite State celebrates Independence Day on June 19th. Stick around to hear the history of Juneteenth. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Erica Janik. This past Tuesday was June 19th, or Juneteenth Independence Day, which commemorates the actual abolition of slavery in Texas, years after the Emancipation Proclamation. It's a holiday that is officially recognized in nearly every state, including here in New Hampshire. Producer Jackie Helbert brings us this piece on Juneteenth in New Hampshire.
My name is Fountain Hughes. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. And now I am 101 years old.
We were slaves. We belonged to people. They sell us like they sell horses and cows and hogs and all like that. Have an auction bench and they put you up on the bench and beat on you the same as you're bidding on cattle, you know.
The Atlantic slave trade forcibly brought more than 10 million Africans to the Americas.
As a matter of fact, for New Hampshire, the story of slavery being in New Hampshire is not often taught. We don't really know that part. We're a proud abolitionist state, right? But we were just as conflicted as anywhere else in the country on the issues of enslavement and freedom. Portsmouth, Exeter, enslavement of Africans was a fabric of America's history.
Time to cut tobacco. If they want you to cut all night long, let me see you, you cut. And if they want you to hang all night long, you hang tobacco. It didn't matter about your tie being tied, you're afraid to say you're tied.
Okay, my name is Ayla Thorntona. I am from Nashville, New Hampshire, and I go to school at UMass Amherst. I'm black, but I also know I'm African-American, not just black. I do know I come from Africa, my family, so that does hit me deeper because my family was slaves.
For New Hampshire, the story of slavery being in New Hampshire is not often taught.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really know that part.
But the thing that old woman told old woman cat in the peach orchard, and whipped her, and, you know, just tied her hand this way, you know, around the peach orchard tree. I remember that just as well, looked like to me, I can. And round the tree and whipped her. And well, she couldn't do nothing but just kick her feet, you know, just kick her feet. But it just had her clothes all down to her waist, you know. Just didn't have her plumb naked, but they had her clothes down to her waist. And every now and then they'd whip her, you know, and then snuff the pipe out on her, you know, snuff pipe out on her. You know, the embers in the pipe, and where you'll see the pipe smoking.
Blow them out on?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good Lord, have mercy.
Swing low, sweet chariot, come in, but carry me home.
Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. It really was symbolic in many ways because when he issued it in January 1863, it did not go into effect. In other words, the South or the Confederates did not free their slaves at that time.
We celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation by Lincoln as a time when slavery ended in this country. And that's what our textbooks say. That's what our histories say. But there were pockets of slavery all over the country, you know, even then.
Let freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring.
Just like New Hampshire, we didn't have a proclamation that said, you know, all the enslaved people are free. It was gradual.
You know, and old Marshall didn't tell you, it was free.
He didn't tell you that?
No, he didn't tell. They waited, I think now they said they waited them 6 months out of that, 6 months, and turned them loose on the 19th of June. That's why, you know, you celebrate that day, colored folks. Celebrate that day. Celebrate that day.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And
it was on June 19th, 1865, that Union General Gordon Granger landed at Galveston and announced that the state's 200,000 black slaves were free.
Go home to my Lord and be free.
Maybe someone in my family line was in Texas and had no idea.
Here in New Hampshire, people don't even know what Juneteenth is. They're not aware of it.
A Desi Okori.
What was your reaction when you first heard Juneteenth?
I actually don't even know I had no idea what my conception of what that meant was. That's a problem. I'm a black woman, right? Figured that would come up in my family, or that would come up in my schooling, or that would come up in the civil rights part of my history class. It doesn't.
Juneteenth is the longest African-American black celebration in the country. So it's carried on since 1865, continuously across the country. And most states recognize it as a holiday. Not yet in New Hampshire.
See? And if we got free, we didn't know not who to do. But we didn't have no property, we didn't have no home, we had nowhere, nothing, we didn't have nothing on it, just like your cattle, just turned out and get along the best you could.
Mom and them didn't know where to go, you see, after freedom broke, just like you turned something out, you know, didn't know where to go. That's just where they stayed. Mm-hmm. Didn't know where to go.
Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee.
What we do for the Black Heritage Trail is we put the holiday in its historical context to put history in a current place because, you know, everything becomes historical at one point. So we get to look at historical issues and how they affect us today. And we also get to celebrate with music and dance and food and be in community. And in New Hampshire, we're in a diverse community.
When all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual. Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty.
Thank God Almighty.
You just heard sound from Tuesday's Juneteenth event at the Arlington Street Community Center in Nashua, gathered by reporter Daniela Ali, and from a conversation between producer Taylor Quimby and Jerrianne Bogus, director and founder of the Black Heritage Trail in Portsmouth. After the break, we're visiting the murderous, miniature world of Frances Glessner Lee and her nutshell studies. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Erica Janik. These days, in the age of CSI and law and order, it's not all that unusual to be fascinated by forensics. But in the 1940s, the whole field was still figuring itself out, far from the public eye. And it was very much relegated to police officers and medical professionals, all of them male, with one very unique exception. Hannah McCarthy brings us the story of the mother of forensic science.
Eugene Black is lying on a couch in a cozy sitting room. A bottle of whiskey is by his side. There's a fire burning in the wood stove and a small dog is sniffing at his shoulder. This is how his daughter, Winifred, found him. She'd been upstairs when she heard the groans and called the doctor as soon as she came down. By the time he arrived, Eugene was dead. The medical examiner called it acute alcoholism, and Eugene was known as the town drunk. But something just seems a bit off here. Something about the shed out back and the velvet-paneled stairs and the fire in the wood stove. Everything feels like it needs a closer look. Before we go any further here, it's worth noting that Eugene has been lying on that couch since 1947, and that he's a porcelain doll.
I was just happy that I found it and didn't just like break it or drop it or, you know, anything rash like that.
This is Nigel Manley. He's the director of the Rocks Estate in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, where Eugene Black's death scene was discovered hidden away in a box in the attic.
And then it was good because we kept it in the carrying box here for years until the Heritage Museum got set up. And then we finally, to my relief, got it out of here.
You can still see the tiny death scene on display at the Bethlehem Heritage Center. Eugene Black lies in state, the circumstances of his final moments on display for any amateur sleuth to analyze. As miniatures go, this particular dollhouse is a bizarre one, but it's actually pretty mild compared to the others.
Yeah, I mean, she wants to make it so that people would jump to a conclusion of what's going to happen and then have to really use the training they were getting so that they would figure out what really happened.
The architect of Eugene Black's demise is Frances Glessner Lee. She started making these dollhouses of death in the 1940s.
They said she was just way ahead of her time.
Nigel says that he knew about Frances's model-making hobby, but the more he learned about her and what she was doing with them, the more remarkable it all became.
First, I just accepted it, and then when you look at through the history and realize that women just didn't do anything like that, I mean, really work-wise, you know, it was kind of weird that she chose that.
What Frances chose was to recreate cases, sometimes an amalgam of various cases, at a 1/12 scale. A farmer found hanged in his own barn. A teenage girl bludgeoned and stabbed in an empty parsonage. A family of three who didn't make it through the night.
And it's a horribly tragic scene in lots of ways because there's a baby that has been shot that's in her crib, but there is a pool of blood on the floor that does not belong to the baby, and it's very intriguing. And then you go to the bedroom and you see that there is a mother who has been shot in her bed, and as gruesome and awful as that sounds, there's something very beautiful about this doll in bed. And then her husband looks like he's maybe fallen off the bed, and he's also been shot.
Susan Marks first heard about Frances's work when she was in grad school.
I heard that there was a collection of dollhouse crime scenes somewhere in Baltimore.
The collection, comprised of 18 extremely detailed deaths, has a permanent home at the chief medical examiner's office in Baltimore where they're used for training. Susan wanted to make a documentary about the nutshell studies, and after convincing them that her motives were pure, Susan was given access to the nutshells, and she got to see them in action.
It was three detectives from the Baltimore homicide, and they took it extremely seriously. And it was a bit chilling, and it went on for a while.
And context was important, because these models weren't just some morbid hobby of Frances Glessner Lee's. She made them for instructional purposes. The tiny scenes sit in custom display shelves. They're pulled out a few times a year for trainees, armed with small flashlights, to pore over and analyze. Tiny deaths frozen in time, with real evidence and red herrings alike planted throughout the scene.
They really talk through every different scenario. And if something didn't make sense, then they would just need to take another step back. So, like, could it have been someone who broke into the house? Was the person still in the house hiding? Was the murderer one of the people that they committed suicide as well?
And if this sounds a little absurd, three grown men, hardened homicide detectives at that, poking around a dollhouse?
They weren't joking around. They weren't smiling because they were dolls and that's supposedly silly or something like that. Not at all. They took it immensely serious, and they found that this is really, really helpful for exploring all the different scenarios, because on an actual crime scene, you don't have that kind of time and energy. And of course, you don't have that bird's eye view.
The Nutshells have been on active duty for the better part of 70 years.
And, you know, part of it was through George Burgess McGrath, her brother's friend from Harvard. And he was the one who pointed out to her, you know, there are these different schools, but there's no school to train medical examiners.
This is Corinne Botts. Her book, The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, explores the 18 models through photographs and research on Frances Glessner Lee. Frances had a personal interest in forensic science. And when it came to putting that into action, she chose to improve the field however she could.
So she saw a need, and she really liked, you know, she craved work that hadn't been done by someone else. So she saw this as like an opportunity. And it's really amazing that how late in life she was able to redefine her role in society.
Frances was in her 50s before she did any work in forensic science. She'd been born in Chicago into immense wealth and social privilege. She married by the time she was 20, had three kids, and later divorced. She chose to spend most of her life living year-round at the family's summer estate in New Hampshire. It was there that she was visited by a friend of her brother's who also happened to be a medical examiner. The stories that he told Frances fascinated her. And when she found herself the only heir to the family fortune, she decided to take what she'd learned over the years and endow a legal medicine department at Harvard.
Yeah, well, she was really ahead of her time in identifying a lot of different issues that continue to be important, like, issues or problems today. You know, the need for trained medical examiners, and the importance of training police officers, because they're oftentimes the very first to arrive at a crime scene.
Frances learned of police officers unintentionally making a mess of these crime scenes, moving bodies and destroying evidence. They didn't do it on purpose. They just weren't trained.
You know, if they botched the crime scene, there's nothing that can be done.
Frances knew how to make models. Really good models. It happened to be a popular pastime for wealthy women in the Gilded Age. She once constructed a perfect scale model of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And so it occurred to her, why not make a crime scene that won't be disturbed, based on cases she'd been studying for a decade?
She taps into New Hampshire and the cases that she was going around and looking at with officers, and that she probably felt that they weren't getting the attention that they deserved. But she also is picking the ones that would baffle these detectives in training, these sort of obscure, weird things that would happen in the cases.
Mrs. Lee called up and wanted a good carpenter to come up and make some bookshelves for her.
This is Alton Mosier. His father, Ralph Mosier, helped build many of Frances's nutshells.
And so my dad did the work, and she liked him. Then she called him back, and she says, Ralph, do you think you could make miniature models for me that we could send to Harvard Medical School?
The first model would be the case of the hanging farmer. Ralph built the barn with reclaimed wood from an actual century-old barn, carefully crafting doors and windows and floors to appear realistic, while Frances decorated the interior and painted the farmer's face to reflect the effects of asphyxiation. Altogether, Ralph helped Frances with 17 of her nutshell studies.
My dad worked for her 10 years, and then he had a heart attack.
I got stuck going to Korea. And I come back, and I didn't have a house. I didn't have a job. Darned if that day, Mrs. Lee called me up, and she says, "Do you think you could do your dad's work?" Well, I said I'd try.
Alton knew carpentry and full-scale furniture making, but miniatures were a different game altogether. And these weren't just any miniatures. They were Francis Lee's crime scenes. They had to be perfect.
She taught me so much of being right. Time didn't mean nothing. If I took all the time in the world to build it, and it was wrong, and she'd criticize. Oh, boy. She was a tough, tough girl, I'll tell you that.
Alton tells the story of a rocking chair he built based on one Francis actually owned.
"Alton, I see something wrong with it already," she says. She says, "The original has got a knot in the handle." Okay, so I had to go out in the woods, get a knot to scale, take it out, put that knot in the same spot that was in the original chair. That's...
You couldn't just paint the knot?
No, sir. That would be no.
That same rocking chair, which Alton now has in his own collection, also happens to convert to a tiny cradle. It's almost inconceivably detailed in its realism and scale. But that was Frances's way. She hand-painted labels on tiny canned goods. She rolled centimeter-long cigarettes from scraps of paper and then burned them until they were half-smoked. Her doll brooms effectively sweep. The pages of her wall calendars curl at the edges. And she sewed or knitted every doll outfit herself.
She'd come up in that elevator, then she'd go down where she worked. Now, she'd take these long common pins and make these caps. And she'd be knitting there. She says, "Alton, come here for a minute." She says, "I'm sticking my fingers with the pins. Why don't you round them off, you know?" So I go in, some crazy thing like that.
Alton spent 10 years working as Francis's personal carpenter. Most of that decade was spent in his workshop. But on occasion, he got a closer look at her devotion to forensics and extreme precision.
We got in the morgue. Here they got this body out on a slab. I sat down and she starts opening up her lunch and start eating it. And Jesus, they start bringing in little kids where the parents smashed them all up. And so I said, "Mrs. Lee, I'm going out and get a little fresh air. I'll be back, pick you up." So... It was tough for me to go through that. But she, I don't know what the idea was, it just to see a dead body and how they cut them up to pull out the bullets and stuff. She went through, and she'd ask them all kinds of questions.
Alton said Francis would sit in the morgue and question the medical examiner, sometimes stumping them. She was unafraid of probing, ensuring everything was correct, even in the midst of an autopsy.
You could see how strong that person is. Yeah. Yeah. Smart. And you couldn't do something that she couldn't figure out. It wasn't the way she wanted it.
She certainly was a very resilient person.
This is Susan Marks again.
A lot of times people didn't take her seriously, and she knew it. But that didn't stop her, because she wasn't the kind of person who would let that stop her. She just wanted to keep proving again and again that she knew what she was talking about. She wasn't just a woman who had money and was throwing it at the university and let them run with it. No, she wanted to be a part of it.
After finishing her documentary, Susan says, she was dissatisfied with the lack of information available about Francis's life. She began interviewing surviving family members. She uncovered more of Francis's papers. And she even made a FOIA request with the FBI for information on Francis.
One thing that really troubled me was reading the FBI files on her and how they, J. Edgar Hoover and the people that he consulted with, really had a... I don't want to say a poor opinion of Frances, but they treated her as a nuisance and they found her personality abrasive. And what she was trying to do was to convince them to have a national dental database to help identify remains better. I mean, what an incredible idea.
For all of her contributions, some of which continue to be used in police training today, Frances Glessner Lee is far from a household name. Susan says it's for the same reason that Frances was unable to become a certified forensic scientist in her lifetime. She's a woman. And yet, her nutshells and her name are gaining more attention all the time. Now, part of that might be because we as a nation love CSI. But there's also something undeniably enduring about these death scenes. Once you get past the morbidity of a tiny dead doll, Frances's detail and nuance keeps your attention. It makes you look twice and second guess, which means that Frances is still managing to get her way.
So things that were stupid bothered her a lot. And the fact that these crimes could be solved and people were just not putting the resources in the right place and not looking in the right place and not putting time and energy into righting these wrongs and having justice served really troubled her, because it didn't need to be that way. And she was that way about everything. If it was stupid, she had zero tolerance for it and would try to make everything right and try to help people understand why something was stupid, like people getting away with murder, when it didn't need to be that way.
Spent the entire second half of her life devoted to forensic science. Did she ever get an official degree?
So that's one strange blip in Frances's life. I'd imagine it would have been really difficult for her to become a medical examiner or forensic investigator either way, but she never did go to college.
Wow.
And it seems like she really resented that fact, actually. There's a Saturday Evening Post article where she's quoted saying that her father believed a lady didn't go to school. But Corinne Botts, who photographed the nutshells and wrote about Frances, says it's still not clear exactly why she didn't.
I wonder, though, if Frances had gone to college and been able to study medicine, if she would have actually founded the legal medicine department or made those nutshells. She probably had to get creative to participate.
Yeah, I think that's right. Frances actually describes her own life as lonely and terrifying.
Oh, Frances.
I know. And I asked Susan Marks about this, and she thinks it has a lot to do with how Frances chose to live her life. She's this really wealthy woman. She could have chosen a comfortable, easy path, but instead she spent most of her days as the only woman in the room, surrounded by guys, and she often had to fight to be taken seriously. And the rest of the time she was doing this time-consuming, tedious work of creating these miniature death scenes.
Did it pay off for her during her lifetime?
Well, so here's something that I thought was super cool. She was named a state police captain in New Hampshire.
Yay, New Hampshire.
Yay! And she was the first woman to achieve that status in the United States. And I would imagine for a while thereafter.
Absolutely. Though, just to be pedantic, I don't think that women were actually allowed to become police captains until the 1960s. So.
Yeah. So she was crazy ahead of her time. And she was honored by other police departments across the country. So she may not have achieved exactly the role that she wanted, but Frances did genuinely make an impact on death scene investigation. And these days, she's considered the mother of forensic science.
I mean, her nutshells are still being used to train investigators. It sounds like she's still really relevant.
Yeah, I think she is. I actually spoke with someone here in New Hampshire who's doing this kind of work every day.
Kim Fallon. I'm the chief forensic investigator at the New Hampshire Medical Examiner's Office.
So Kim gets called into death scenes to observe and document everything before the police ever arrive on the scene. And she's been doing this since 1993. And she actually says that when she was trained for the job, it wasn't really comprehensive. Almost all of her training was done in the office. She only trained at one death scene. So when she had her first solo case, that was pretty much the first time she was doing hands-on investigatory work.
My first several cases, I was there for hours. You know, the police would be outside waiting in their car, and I'd go out, and they'd be looking like, what is taking you so long?
Kim actually reminds me a little bit of Frances in this respect. She says that when she didn't feel confident as an investigator, she went looking for workshops. She did a ton of reading. She flew to Arizona to take a death investigation course. And she says that after all of that, she started to really feel like she knew what she was doing.
It's kind of amazing that so long after Frances's time, forensic investigation training is still kind of spotty.
Yeah, well, Kim says it's actually really different today, finally.
The training now is really different. And I've been here for 13 years full time in the office. And the training is, it's about 55 hours of classroom training, and it covers every type of death and all of the other things that we need to know. And then the trainees have to go to 20 death scenes with an experienced investigator, and they also have to view 20 autopsies. So they really have a lot more comprehensive training before they're out on their own.
So what does the training look like? How are these investigators supposed to approach a death scene?
Well, it really depends.
Well, it's different. Depending on what type of death it is, you know, there's different things that you look for at motor vehicle crashes, when it's a gunshot wound case, when it's an overdose case. And when we train people, we train them, you know, specifically, this is what you're looking for at this type of cases, but also they have to be open-minded and realize that it could be something else.
Now that sounds more like Frances's approach.
Yeah, Kim says that investigators have to take note of everything. So at a car crash, they're looking at the skid marks, the curve in the road, whether there's a seatbelt bruise on the body, whether there's a pattern of glass on someone's face. And they're also supposed to determine whether the injuries correspond to the scene. In other words, is this death as it appears?
Another example would be, and this was many years ago, but there was a car crash where two people had died. And, you know, by the time our investigator got there, I think the tow truck was there, you know, the police were there, they had done their thing, the funeral home was there. And he was checking out the two people that had died in the car, and they had died of gunshot wounds. It was a murder-suicide. And then when they realized that, they went back and realized that the glass from the window had fallen out before they ever hit the pole or the tree or whatever they hit.
I mean, that really tells you how vital forensic work is. I mean, an officer could be looking at a crime and not even know it without some really thorough, close looks.
Yeah, that's exactly what Frances was trying to teach later in life, I think. These murders were going unsolved or maybe even unnoticed. Like, a murder could appear to be a suicide, for example, or a natural death could appear as a wrongful death. It's impossible to get real justice when a death scene is just totally misinterpreted. And that's why Frances's nutshell studies are so realistic and have so many details. They're not about figuring out who done it. They're about identifying every piece of evidence, carefully weighing the possibilities, and getting rid of all presumptions about a scene.
But do any of these nutshells actually have solutions? Did you solve any crimes while you were reporting this story?
So there are solutions, which the Baltimore Medical Examiner's Office keeps on lockdown because they're still using the nutshells for training. However, Alton Mosier did happen to reveal to me a solution to one of the nutshells.
Ooh.
The guy came in here, and she was fighting. She pulled this curtain down, and they took the copper, a brass thing off, and killed the woman upstairs. The story they say isn't the right one. And then when he came down, in the back of the woodpile is where he took the brass piece that was all full of blood that murdered her upstairs.
But which one is that the solution for?
I'd tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
If you want to know more about Frances Glessner Lee and her nutshells, you can check out Corinne Botz's book, The Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, or Susan Marks' documentary of Dolls and Murder. Susan's working on a second documentary about Frances and her life's work. She hopes to release it soon. If you want to check out a nutshell in person, and you really should, you can check out Sitting Room and Woodshed at the Bethlehem Heritage Society. Special thanks this week to the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forests and everybody at the Rocks Estate. This week's episode was produced by Hannah McCarthy, Taylor Quimby, Lauren Chulgen, Justine Paradise, Jackie Helbert, and me, Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is Director of Solving Any Crime by Dinner Time. Music in this week's episode is by Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Amethyst Kia, and Kevin McLeod. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.